Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, maybe one that influenced their own work. Today, I'm really excited to have writer, producer, Issa Mathay. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Let me give you guys a quick primer on Issa Mitzay's work. So Issa is a writer from Boulder, Colorado. She graduated from UC Berkeley in 2013, where she majored in Russian and Italian literature, focusing on futurism and the avant-garde. Oh.
It's not, I have weird tastes.
Not heavy at all, right? Well, there she was editor-in-chief of several literary journals and went on to have a career in web development before diving into the adult industry as a cam girl. Now, that's relevant because using that experience, she co-created and wrote a script called Cam. Cam is a psychothriller centering on a moderately successful cam girl named Lola, who's attempting to level up and be a top earner and fan favorite. Unfortunately, when she finally reaches that pinnacle of her industry, a mysterious woman begins passing herself off as Lola, and Lola's life unravels as she tries to figure out the identity and origins of her new twin. Cam is now a Blumhouse production and is directed by Issa's collaborator, Daniel Goldhaber. It premiered at this year's Fantastic Fest and was called a, quote, sexy and sinister thrill ride that is, quote, bone-crunching tense. Ooh. Cam is available to watch on Netflix as of November 16th, 2018. In her free time, Issa's also been working on a book. Her forthcoming memoir, Cam Girl, will be published in November 2019. She is also in development on her second feature film, a thriller about a female serial killer. Well, I think you got some taste there.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, Issa, the film that you chose to talk about today is Jennifer's Body.
Hell yeah.
So if you could give me a quick rundown on why you chose that movie.
I freaking love Jennifer's Body. I feel like it was underappreciated and now it's having like a little moment.
Where it's weird,
people,
right?
It's having a moment. Yeah. And I chose it because, you know, I remembered loving it all those years ago when it came out and watching it. And I actually found the DVD that I had from high school. Mm-hmm. And I watched it again. I was like, this is really good. Like, why isn't this thought of as a really good movie?
No, absolutely. And in fact, I rewatched it when Karin Kusama came on Switchblade Sisters for her episode and was like, oh, that's right. I actually do really enjoy this movie. People told me I would not.
Really?
People told me I wouldn't. They're like, oh, it's not that good.
Really?
Like, oh, that's interesting. So thinking back on it now, you know, what the fuck were they thinking?
Exactly. And I mean, I think maybe people just didn't get it. Maybe we weren't looking at it in the right lens. Maybe we weren't used to horror also being hysterically funny.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's something we're more open to now, looking at, like, I don't know, Happy Death Day and things like that. Mm-hmm. We're like, oh, yeah, horror can be fun. You know, it can make us laugh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm open to whatever explanation we can figure out. For those of you who haven't seen Jennifer's Body, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause this episode and watch Jennifer's Body first, this is your chance. Now let's reintroduce Jennifer's Body for you guys. Written by Diablo Cody and directed by Karin Kusama for release in 2009, Jennifer's Body stars Megan Fox and Amanda Seyfried as best frenemies Jennifer and Anita. Jennifer's a popular cheerleader who hasn't dumped Anita's friendship, even though it seems like that's probably inevitable. One night, Jennifer drags Anita to a club to see an indie band called Low Shoulder. I love that fucking name.
So good.
Suddenly, a fire breaks out and kills a bunch of people in the club. The band wants Jennifer to leave with them in their van. Anita protests, but Jennifer goes anyway. Later that night, Jennifer shows up at Anita's house, covered in blood. Jennifer tries to devour some food, but vomits it up immediately, like a thick tar, disgusting,
yeah, black.
Next day, Jennifer's at school and totally normal, even though everyone's grieving the students who died in the fire. Jennifer then seduces a football captain and disembowels him in the woods. Something is very wrong with Jennifer. A few weeks later, Jennifer looks pale as fuck. She's dying, it looks like. It's then when she accepts a date with the resident emo kid, only to lure him into a trap and kill him. Meanwhile, Anita loses her virginity, but also senses something is deeply off about Jennifer. Jennifer finally confesses to Anita that Low Shoulder had taken her into the woods and tried to offer her up to Satan as a virgin sacrifice so they could have fame and fortune. But Jennifer lied to Low Shoulder, or actually she didn't lie. It was her friend Anita who did. She wasn't actually a virgin, and so she became possessed. As long as she eats a fresh boy every month or so, she's basically unstoppable. Anita finds out that Jennifer's become a succubus and makes a plan to kill her at the big school dance when she's become weak after not feeding. Unfortunately, Jennifer gets her hands on Anita's boyfriend first and starts feeding on him. He's able to impale her, but she escapes. Later on, Anita shows up at Jennifer's house, they fight, and Anita stabs her in the heart. When Jennifer's mom sees the scene, Anita is committed to a mental institution. Yeah, why would you stab your best friend in the heart?
You're crazy.
And she's a succubus. We then find out that Anita inherited some of Jennifer's powers during the fight. We see her escape the mental institution on her way to catch a Low Shoulder show and to inflict vengeance. Hmm. There we go.
It's fun.
It's fun.
It's fun. Not dark at all.
I want to get into the Diablo Cody's role in this, because she had written this script at the same time that she was writing Juno. It's just that Juno had gone into production first, but they were at the exact same time. I think she was like going back and forth on the script simultaneously. So even though those are two very different films, you can see a direct line between them, both dealing with teens and both with some biting comedy. Here's how Cody described her writing process at the time. She said, quote, "When I first set out to write this, I intended to write something very dark, very brooding, a traditional slasher movie. And then I realized about a third of the way into the process, I was incapable of doing that because the humor just kept sneaking in. I have a macabre sense of humor. A lot of things in the movie that are horrifying are funny to me. I've always said that I think comedy films and horror films are kind of similar in the sense that you can actually witness the audience having a physical release. They're laughing, they're screaming. It's not a passive experience," end quote. I find that very true in Jennifer's body, that the lines between humor and horror are quite blurred, obviously. And I'm really curious, you know, if we could talk about that kind of process of allowing humor to come into something that is terrifying. Because, you know, your movie itself also has a lot of laugh lines.
There are jokes, yeah.
To it, you know. Yeah. And I mean, it's you know, it's very dark, but there's definitely quite a bit of humor. And, you know, let's talk about the funniest lines in this film, too. You know, what's your favorite?
Oh my God, there's so many. I love the ending though, when she stabs her with the box cutter, and Megan Fox goes, "Ow, my tit."
My tit. No, your heart.
And it's making such a humorous moment out of like the most dramatic ending of a film. She's killing her best friend and this object of her love and desire, and it's still funny. And I love that.
And the humor still stems out of the characters. You know, the fact that she says, "Oh, my tit," is very on brand for Jennifer.
Totally exactly what she would say. And that's why you can get away with it, I think. I think that's why, you know, you don't watch it and you're not brought out of it. And I mean, that's what I love in horror in general, is I think, like you said, it's a place that we can process traumas and we can process these dark fears that we have. And there's no reason we can't laugh at them, too, you know? And I think Jennifer's body does a great job of both, where it is scary, but I'm also laughing the whole time.
It's an interesting thing. Diablo Cody said, you know, a lot of people asked her in interviews if she was, like, you know, if high school was terrible for her. Because all these writers are like, yeah, high school is terrible for me. And so, you know, you look at this and you're like, oh, well, maybe it's, like, an allegorical thing from, like, her experience of, like, maybe she's needy. And she's like, no, it was great. I had a great time. People loved me. I was funny. And I was like, what?
I mean, I think high school is just a weird place. It's like such a claustrophobic, like self-contained, unnatural environment for anyone. And so I think even if high school was good, that doesn't mean it wasn't weird and messed up in some ways, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the microcosm of high school and the way that people, you know, like, feed off of each other. I'll say feed, even, you know, it's very thematically in keeping with Jennifer's body. But, you know, everyone's at the Low Shoulder show. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that's the thing, like, the place to be. It's like a small town and everyone knows each other. And
even on this focus on, like, who's a virgin, who's not a virgin, who's having sex, who's dating who, you know, that kind of, like, gossipy environment of high school, I think, is in the film as well. And it's really accurate.
Also, something else about what Diablo Cody said, that quote, is the idea that you can't fight your own instincts when you're writing something. Mm-hmm. And I was curious, you know, like, were you setting out when you wrote Cam to write something that was subversive in this darkly humorous manner? Or did you want to write a traditional slasher and you're like, oh, well, this is actually quite funny?
Yeah, I mean, the humor was definitely accidental. I did not intend for it to be funny, but I did intend for it to be subversive. Like, I intended it to be a movie where you're rooting for a sex worker in the sex work experience.
Yeah.
And you want her to stay in the sex work experience.
Yeah.
Which is incredibly subversive. And that was kind of the goal from the beginning, was to kind of, like, subvert expectations at every turn, where you expect it to be a morality story. You expect her to learn her lesson and never go back to porn. And instead, you're rooting for her to go back, you know? And that was really important to me.
But there had to be moments, too, where you were, you know, maybe trying to even dramatize certain things that you could pull from your own life, where once you get distance, you're like, that's actually hilarious.
Definitely.
I mean,
definitely.
Were there any scenes or things that you remember where you're like, I thought that was dramatic, but it's actually funny as hell?
I mean, I think a lot of the scenes with Lola are funny. Like, towards the end, Lola becomes such a disembodied, almost like, I mean, she's not a robot, but we almost refer to her as, like, a sex robot, because she's just so different from Alice. And a lot of that was Maddie just, like, you know, taking on this life of its own. And I watched those scenes and I'm like, Madeline Brewer, the lead actress.
Who
in the film,
lot of people know from Hulu's Handmaid's Tale.
She's Janine in Handmaid's Tale.
Who lost
yeah.
her eye, that character.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. Sometimes people see the movie and they're like, oh, I didn't realize she has two eyes. Yeah, that's who she is. I didn't recognize her with the second eye. But I think a lot of the Lola scenes are really funny. And then, you know, there are some scenes that I intended to be funny in the writing process. You know, I was writing this scene where she meets Barney and they're at a Mexican restaurant. And it was this really intense, like, girl with the dragon tattoo investigation, where she's clever and getting information.
And, yeah, then, and Barney is one of her fans, her patrons.
Yeah, he's one of her patrons, and she's trying to manipulate him for information. And then, you know, I was thinking, like, wait, like, most of the Mexican restaurants I know are, like, absurd. You know,
yes.
They have the mariachi band, and there's actually a place in Colorado where they have, like, cliff divers and a waterfall, and it's so kitschy and ridiculous. And I was just like, this scene should be funny.
Yeah.
Like, this should be the scene where we're making fun of that Mexican restaurant that's trying too hard to be a Mexican restaurant.
And do you know what you want for lunch?
Yeah, let me get the big boy burrito bowl. No sour cream, no cheese, no beans.
No beans?
No beans.
I'll have a veggie chimichanga.
The cheesy cheetah chimichanga. Que bueno.
I love the authenticity.
It's quirky.
Yeah, and it adds texture to the story, too, because you're getting these characters. You're letting their environment inform how the scene is going to play out.
Yeah. Yeah,
I have to say, there's one place where Diablo Cody realized that they did have to cut out jokes and Jennifer's body. It was the scene where they were sacrificing Jennifer to Satan. Mm-hmm. So Cody said, quote, that scene was always a concern to us because it really is dark. And we're never quite sure what to do with it. Initially, there were more jokes in that scene because we kept trying to lighten the mood. And eventually, a lot of the humor was taken out of it, and it was like, okay, this is serious. We knew that this is the moment upon which the entire film hinges, and so maybe they shouldn't really be joking around. It was tough. There really were challenges in every scene. You know, is this funny enough? Is this scary enough? Too funny? Too scary? Neither. So that's her thinking about that scene. And if you remember, you know, and if people haven't seen this movie in a little while, they're, you know, like, they're in the woods. Jennifer's, I think, like, on her knees or something. And this low shoulder band, you know, is standing around them. And it does take a turn for a more serious thing. And you can see that Jennifer is actually very frightened, and you're quite worried for her safety. Can we talk about the times when you realize that it has to be more serious, when you can't just kind of use a defense mechanism of a joke?
Yeah. And I mean, I think that scene does it so well, where it's this balance between, like, Jennifer is genuinely terrified and it's not funny, they're not joking, but they are talking so casually about what's about to happen.
We come here tonight to sacrifice the body of Jennifer from Devil's Kettle.
Please, please. Please, please don't do this. I'll do anything. I'll do anything.
Do you know how hard it is to make it as an indie band these days? There's so many of us. And we're all so cute, and it's like if you don't get on Letterman or some retarded soundtrack, you're screwed. Okay? Satan is our only hope.
And I look to that scene a lot when I look at, you know, this scene in my film, which is the scene where Alice, the protagonist, watches this replica of herself shoot herself in the face. Mm-hmm. And that's a scene where, you know, Lola, the replica, is... she's being kind of flippant and nonchalant. She's like auctioning off this suicide of herself in this really fucked up way. And but for Alice, it's a really terrifying and serious moment. And so it was about creating a similar balance where like the character in it, Lola, or in Jennifer's body, Low Shoulder, like they have to be kind of flippant and lighthearted. And they're like, to them, it's this casual thing. But to mm-hmm. the person it's happening to, it's really, really serious and traumatic.
Yeah. It's just a difficult tonal shift to pull off sometimes, though. I mean, how did you and Daniel Goldhaber work that out?
I mean, it just came from a lot of discussions and having a lot of our friends read things, you know? Like, I think we would have people read these scenes that we wrote and they would just tell us how they made them feel. And sometimes mm-hmm. they would feel upset by them in a way that we didn't want people to feel upset. Sometimes they would feel like we were trivializing what was happening, or sometimes the opposite. They would be like, this is really melodramatic and heavy and like maybe not what you want either. Mm-hmm. And I can't stress enough the value of all of our friends and collaborators who just read draft after draft after draft and gave me that feedback, because it is something when you're in it, sometimes you think something's hilarious and it's super dumb, and sometimes you think something's not funny and people find it funny. And so it's really useful to have other people kind of telling you how they feel about it.
Did you give them like a little checklist of like, do you find this scene funny?
The smiley faces, good. Like rate the humor.
Yeah, like little sticky stars or like happy faces or something.
I would watch people read sometimes, honestly, and just like wait for their mouths to move. Like,
I'm sure that wasn't stressful at all for any of your friends.
I'm sure. I do it to audiences, but they don't see me. I sneak into the theater. I'm like, are you going to laugh? Are you going to laugh?
We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about what happens when a writer has a larger hand in the making of a movie. Okay, quick break.
Hi, I'm Dave.
Hi, I'm Graham.
And we're two house DJs who have been trapped inside our drum machine.
We love it here, and we'd love if you stopped by and visited us every week on Stop Podcasting Yourself
here on MaximumFun.org.
We're just a couple of doofuses from Canada.
And listen to our show or perish. Stop Podcasting Yourself
on MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined here today by Issa Matsay, and we are talking about Jennifer's Body. So because Diablo Cody had already gotten so much acclaim from Juno, when the Jennifer's Body script came up, I think it was on Blacklist, Reitman was in for producing, and Cody was also able to come on as a producer, which meant that she was integral in finding the right director for the script. So that's not always the case, but then she was able to meet Karin Kusama, and this is how she described their compatibility. Quote, "The first time I met Karin, she brought along a lookbook that contained all these images that had inspired her when she was reading the script. And I looked at it, and it was so weird and surreal and bloody. She even had some pictures in there of Dario Argento movies. And I said, all right, I think you and I are going to have a connection, and I think that we can do this together." So they connected on this artistic level. But also on this feminist fuck you level that the two of them have had. I mean, if you read any interviews with either of them, it's very on the surface of everything that they do, although their personalities are a little bit different. Like, Karin is more reserved. Diablo Cody is more effusive. And that secured their creative partnership. But I have to stress that this isn't really how it normally works for screenwriters. You know, they don't get to have a total say often in how their story is told unless mm-hmm. you do it from kind of a grassroots way. And even then, the director seems to have more kind of ownership over it, and yeah. the writer has to take a step back. So that's why, you know, Diablo Cody was like adamant about being a producer. But I like to talk about the process of choosing the right person for the job and then stepping back and letting them do the work. Because I think that Diablo Cody did select the right person for the job, whether it's the special effects, the practical effects, the lighting, the design, mm-hmm. the characters. I think Karin Kusama brought this project to life. And I know that with you developed your script before Daniel or with Daniel?
I developed the script with Daniel, but I was actually way more involved than even a producer. Like, we cast it together. I was in the room for casting. I was mm-hmm. in the office for pre-production. I was helping hire crew and cast, and I was on set. There's a couple scenes that I actually directed. Mm-hmm. So it was really very much like a joint vision from the beginning, and that's kind of why we credit it a film by both of us, which doesn't technically mean anything, but it does to us. It kind of reflects that co-authorship.
Yeah, sometimes credits are a little bit arbitrary, especially if you see people who, I mean, it doesn't encourage collaboration.
No, definitely not. And I think especially when you think about the process of writing, it's like, I'm not writing it and picturing words in my head. I'm picturing the movie. And I'm sure most writers are as well. And so mm-hmm. when you think about this collaboration with a director, you know, it is important to find someone that can kind of see a little bit inside your head, and maybe you can see a little bit into the direction where they can take your script and figure out where that medium is or you know, where that happy place is, where you're both getting the film that you want at the mm-hmm. end of the day.
Well, I mean, and it's also someone who has the right kind of sensitivity to the subject matter as well. I mean, there's a way that Jennifer's body could have been extremely exploitative.
And actually, I think that's part of the reason maybe why it didn't do so well is I remember seeing trailers for it, and I actually rewatched the trailer for it last night, and it seems to be framed in such a way where, like, you're going to get to see Megan Fox's hot body. And, you know, it's very much catering to this male gaze. Whereas I think it's a film that, you know, now especially, like, women want to see this film, you mm-hmm. know, and I don't think it was marketed to women initially. And yeah, I think the same thing with, you know, the politics or the gaze behind the film. That's why I worked with Daniel, is because, you know, people are like, oh, why'd you work with a man? I'm like, we've worked together for over a decade. Like, I know him very well, and I trusted him. Mm-hmm. And I trusted him to listen to me on questions of male gaze and female body representation, and he did. He did, you know, and I feel like that's very rare.
Were there any moments, you know, that you can remember where you got to be instructive on set?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I can think of two. The main one, you know, that I think was more, I mean, there's two. The first would be Madeline, you know, taking off her top to get for a topless scene. And a shout went up on set, you know, where's the ice? Like, where's the ice for her nipples? Mm-hmm. And a PA started running to get ice. And even for me, it took a second for me to be like, whoa, why are we icing her nipples? Like, yeah. we're not going to do that. But it's so standard in film that when there are breasts out, the nipples are going to be hard. You're going to ice her nipples. And of course, as soon as I said that, like, everyone started laughing. They're like, oh, duh, we're not going to ice her nipples. Of course not.
Yeah.
But it was still, you know, this moment where we have to be conscious of every single decision we're making. And, you know, there was another moment when, you know, Danny had, the director had, you know, framed a shot on a bow tie, and he's framing the shot for the bow tie. But what I see from Video Village is Maddie's breasts and not her face in the shot.
Oh, okay.
And so I run on set. I'm like, you need to pan the camera up. And to me, I'm like, it's easy. Just pan the camera up. And to Danny, he's like, no, we have to change the lens. We have to relight. We have to reframe everything. But, you know, and it led to a discussion of, like, why, even though he was framing for the bow tie and intentional, you know, the intentionality behind it was not to be objectifying. Mm-hmm. It was engaging with this legacy of the male gaze in cinema, and it was problematic. And so we had to have a discussion about that. And then he was like, oh, you're right. And they reframed the shot, and they mm-hmm. put the shot, and that's the shot that's in the movie.
I mean, I think that it's an interesting thing to portray sexiness but not exploitativeness.
Yeah,
it's a delicate line, and I think that we're just learning what the difference is.
I think we are. And I think the funniest thing is when people come to me and they're like, oh, there's not a lot of nudity in your film. And I'm like, no, there's actually a lot of nudity. And there's a lot. There's a 2.5-minute scene where the main character is riding a sex machine completely naked.
And it's hilarious. It is a very funny. And you're just like, oh, my God, this is terrible. What is this dystopian?
I know, right? Talking about humor. But, yeah, I think it's funny. People don't even recognize that because the way we framed it and the way we shot it is a sports movie. Like, this is an athletic endurance sports scene. And so it's not even registering as sexy or naked to people. Because it's from Alice's point of view. And to Alice, this is a job. This is her, you know, physical exertion in that job. It's not for her this, like, overtly objectifying experience.
And I would say for Jennifer's body, I mean, it's definitely filmed in a means where Jennifer is scary. She's not merely sexy, she's scary. Mm-hmm. And that kind of usurps often the sexiness, you know, like the cover of Jennifer's body is hilarious to me, having seen the movie again. And she's, you know, Megan Fox is what, laying across a desk, like in a cheerleader's outfit or something, with a chalkboard behind her in the classroom. And it's just, you can hear Megan Fox laughing.
Yes. Exactly.
What a bait and switch.
Totally. Like, not what you're expecting when you walk into that movie.
So I do think that there's a lot to what you said about people expecting it to be sexy because of the trailer and the marketing and the advertising.
And I think it's a lot about the perspective of who's looking at the body, you know, and not filming bodies from the outside perspective. Like, even with Megan Fox and Jennifer's body, like, we're seeing her through the lens of, you know, the men that she's interacting with, or, you know, her best friend who is also kind of in love with her. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, we're going to see her body in a different way. And I think that's really interesting to talk about.
Yeah. You know, speaking more about the marketing, too, something that I thought was fascinating was that the folks at the studio talked to Karin and were just like, oh, we're going to have Megan Fox do like this live interview with actually like cam girls and with sex workers. Mm. And Karin Kusama was just like, I think it's not the right for the movie. Like, the, you know, like, I think you're kind of leaning into the sexiness and like this, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but not for this movie. And if you bring this to Megan Fox, she's going to get dejected. That's what your marketing plan is just that.
Well, it's exploiting. I mean, this isn't even a movie about sex work.
She's
not a sex worker. So you're essentially just exploiting an industry of women, or not exclusively of women, but you're exploiting, you know, an industry that is already exploited enough in the media.
Yes.
And you're using it to sell a movie that it's not even talking about.
It's not even related.
It's not even related.
All. It's about just a teen girl.
A high schooler, by the way. It's not like she could even be in porn.
No.
Right? Like, how old are they? 17, 18?
Yeah, they're supposed to be like 17.
Yeah.
So it's...
Yeah. Why would you have porn stars trying to sell... Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
That's your marketing team.
Yeah.
And like, Karin Kusama was just like the interview I read, she's like, oh, shit, this is not going to go good if this is your ideal.
Yeah.
I think she kind of had like this feeling when they were presenting her these ideas that was not... They didn't know how to handle the movie. And so she was kind of, I think, already ready to, like, prepared for this movie to be a wash because of how they were treating it.
Yeah. And, I mean, I think that's a testament to how things are changing, luckily, is, like, with Cam, you know, we definitely encountered people who were like, oh, I can't wait to have hot, sexy, big-bosomed woman on the cover of this poster.
No.
And you know, and we were like, no, the poster's not going to be sexy. The poster's going to be creepy. It's a creepy movie. And, you know, we had to fight for it every step of the way. But as soon as we found the right partners, they, like, got it. And, you know, that gives me a lot of hope that maybe, you know, 10 years later, things are maybe shifting a little bit in, you know, how we're marketing movies.
Yeah, I hope so. Something I want to get into as well is the casting of this movie. Karin Kusama didn't have a ton of control over casting, actually. You know, it was shared, obviously, with the producers. When she signed on to direct, Megan Fox was already signed on to lead the film, which gave Kusama pause. She had purposely avoided seeing the Transformer movie. But if there were ever a case that an actor is only as good as the material they're given, I think Jennifer's body is that? Because Fox, to me, is obviously underutilized in her other roles and underrated in general after her performance in this film. She is delightfully funny and crass, but also at times greatly vulnerable. And there's so much range for her in this film. I found her extremely compelling. And for her part, she took the role very seriously and even dropped down to 97 pounds to portray a younger, more insecure version of herself. So let's talk a little bit about Megan Fox here.
Yeah.
An enigma.
I think she's so talented. And that's something that about Jennifer's Body, when I rewatched it again, I was like, oh my God, she's so good in this film. And she shows so much range. And I think, you know, she was known for so long just as being the hot girl in Transformers.
Yeah. And she's fine with that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course. And more power to her.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was really cool to see her be able to have so much range and be given so much kind of, you know, freedom in Jennifer's Body to really just like give it all to that performance and be such an interesting character, because she is funny and you like her and you also hate her,
mm-hmm.
and you also, you know, relate to her in a weird way. And I think that's really hard to pull off, especially in a role where you're also like murdering people, you know, mm-hmm. for pleasure.
And, you know, if you read any interview with her around that time, she said that this was the character where she's like, I feel like this was written for me, mm-hmm. because it's kind of like the closest she is in real life, which is, you know, oscillating between just biting sarcasm and also just, you know, having a feeling of like insecurity and then, you know, loving someone deeply. And you know, it just, she said it was pretty much her, and she always wanted to make all the dark jokes that she wants to make on set, but people always tell her to shut up. And this was her excuse to be able to make very dark jokes, was like, no, I'm just in character.
Exactly. I mean, that's fantastic. And I think, you know, I relate to that character a lot as well, to Jennifer. Like, when I see that, I'm like, oh, that's kind of who I was in high school. Like, I was this very insecure, slutty girl who, you know, I took all my clothes off at every party, but at the same time, I went home and hated my body.
Mm-hmm.
And so I saw a lot of myself in that, and I think she did such an incredible job of bringing out that nuance in that character.
That's something that Diablo Cody also, in interviews, she brought up a part of the movie. It's the part where she's like smearing makeup on her face.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I have a quote about that, but it's probably someplace. Oh, yeah. So Cody said, she's smearing makeup on her face. I always thought that was such a sad image. She's so vulnerable. I don't know any woman who hasn't had a moment sitting in front of a mirror and thinking, help me, I want to be someone else. What makes it extra affecting is that Megan Fox is already stunning. And I think, you know, that's something that we don't often see, too, is just the fact that, like, someone who is stunning, as Megan Fox is, will have those moments of just, like, I fucking hate myself.
Totally. And, I mean, that's what I love what they do with Amanda Seyfried is, you know, they put her in glasses. And they're kind of poking fun at this idea that, like, oh, you put glasses on a pretty girl and now she's a nerd somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of pointing a finger at that because she's absolutely beautiful. But, you know, we've decided, oh, she's the nerdy one and Jennifer's the hot one.
Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting how they kind of point that out in the film as well.
I just don't think that I've seen that in horror films, too. I don't think I've seen the hot girl have a moment of vulnerability like that.
Yeah, I think it's really rare. I think it's, you know, we tend to stereotype hot girls, we tend to stereotype slutty girls, and we label them as, you know, perpetually confident or mean or whatever. And I think it's interesting because that's not how people are.
Yeah.
You know, we're all vulnerable in one way or another.
It's interesting also for Cam, too, because Madeline Brewer, your lead, is an extremely beautiful woman. But she also is, you know, obviously fighting a lot of demons of like, am I good enough?
Mm-hmm.
Am I pretty enough?
Mm-hmm.
Why are these other people getting more patrons? You know, what is wrong with me? What else can I do? And, you know, were there any significant scenes for you where you were writing where you're like, this is going to portray, like, you know, even the mindset that you had at the times where you were vulnerable?
Yeah, well, I mean, we have a lot of scenes where she's, you know, flipping through shows of other girls and watching them. Or there's a scene where she's watching, you know, the number one cam girl baby.
Mm-hmm.
And she's, you know, she talks to her cat. She's like, go away, I'm studying. And it's this feeling of like, you know, watching these other girls and saying, okay, why are they doing better than me? And then trying to turn that into something analytical that's like actionable. You know, she's trying to figure out, what can I do to be better? And to some extent, yes, she can do better in her craft. But to another extent, you are operating in a system with biases and prejudices that are going to necessarily put you where you're going to fall.
But you don't understand that in the same way that Jennifer doesn't understand that, you know, the system is designed for you to fail, for you to feel like shit, you know.
Absolutely.
Alice/Lola also doesn't get that.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, no one understands that in high school, especially. Yeah. I think I still barely understand that. You know what I mean? And so I think it's incredibly important to talk about. But yeah, it's hard. It's so hard. And even as someone who like is so aware of all the bullshit in the system, I still look in the mirror and go, oh, my God, I'm getting a wrinkle right here. Like, do I need to get Botox? What am I doing? You know?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are many feminists out there who are also considering plastic surgery and are out. War with themselves.
And to clarify, you know, I think there's nothing wrong with getting plastic surgery.
No.
I think, you know, feminism is about the choice, you know, shave or not shave, Botox your face or don't Botox your face. Like, more power to you either way, you know.
It's, I mean, we're in a new age of feminism. we are constantly facing paradoxes, but you still have to understand that the reality of the world that you live in is that the system is designed for a certain thing. And if it makes you feel confident, and that's what your whole goal is, to feel confident, to do whatever you have to do, then go for it.
I mean, it's whatever makes you feel beautiful and powerful at the end of the day.
Yeah. I'm curious, you know, we're talking about these moments of vulnerability we're talking about that we don't often see in horror films that acknowledge that. Does it matter when a woman writes a horror film? Does it matter that, you know, like, could those scenes have been written by men? Do you often see them written by men? This is one of those discussions we get into a lot where women aren't a monolith. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there are certain things that they have different access to.
I think it needs to be. We always like to talk, Danny and I, about this film being a dialogue. Mm-hmm. And it had to be a dialogue. Like, I needed him to bring so much of his film and, you know, cinematic expertise into the film.
Mm-hmm.
But he absolutely needed me as well to bring a lot of those female experiences into the world. And, you know, I made him Cam before we shot the film.
Oh, that's
so
right. He said that. Yeah.
Yeah. I made him go online naked and Cam. And I didn't make him. I asked him. But, you know, I strongly requested. But, you know, and he got this small taste of this vulnerability, and he came to me afterwards and he said, I don't understand what I'm doing wrong. Everyone's just asking me to do stuff for free. And I was just like, yeah, welcome to being a woman. Like,
here's an experience I can share with you that is near universal, at least.
Yeah. And I think it's really easy to, like, attach women to a project and say, okay, now it's fine. But it's not about just attaching a woman. You have to listen to what she's saying. And that goes for any voice that's underrepresented. You have to listen to them and trust that they know their experience better than you. You can read every book in the world and you're not going to understand it as well as someone who lived it.
Yeah. Like, I find it, you know, like, it's okay if men direct movies by women, if straight people direct movies about gay people, but you can tell the ones where that dialogue doesn't exist.
Exactly. And they're not as good of movies for anyone.
Yeah.
Like, you can feel that there. And so I think the more that we, like, engage in these conversations, the better film we're going to have, or media across the board.
So you had mentioned also Amanda Seyfried and her being the less pretty one of the two, cast as the less pretty one. When she was doing interview rounds for the film, she said, being a lead, you have that weird pressure of feeling like you have to look attractive. In this movie, I don't worry about any of that shit. I don't want to play the one that everybody is supposed to want to have sex with. So at that point in her career, she could have been playing the lead in this film. You know, that was totally possible. But she wanted to play the supporting character because of that pressure. And Fox seemed to be fine with that pressure. So it worked. Mm-hmm. They enjoyed kind of switching that role. And, you know, I'm curious about that in terms of acting. You've got your lead actor, Madeline Brewer, having to bear so much of her soul and her body. And that sacrifice is not small. You know, that's something that, you know, I'm curious how you make an actor her feel comfortable in that. I mean, clearly, obviously, Megan Fox was comfortable being the lead and, you know, being sexy. And that's something that she was totally primed for and was excited. Amanda Seyfried was not as excited about that. And so it was a great match for them. But, you know, how do you get an actor into that space?
I mean, I think the most important thing we did was we gave her full control. 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we obviously had to have a nudity rider, or, like, our lawyers wouldn't let us make the movie.
Yeah.
But day of, on set, Maddie decided how much she showed and when she showed it. And what that led to was, because she had so much agency and control over what she was showing and when, she really engaged with when the nudity was coming from a place of character and when it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't, you know, some days there was less nudity than written. And some days she wanted more nudity than written, because she would say, no, I think Alice is going to be naked in this scene.
Mm-hmm.
And she pushed us on that, and she really engaged with us. And because of that, you know, going back to what we were saying earlier, I think that's why the nudity maybe doesn't feel gratuitous, is because it's coming from a place of character, where Madeline is really engaging with those thoughts and saying, when would Alice actually be naked?
Mm-hmm.
Not when does the director or the writer want me to be naked?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that gave her a lot of comfort there. And I think also, you know, we just had a lot of conversations, like, even before she was cast, we met for coffee and we just talked for like a couple hours about, you know, the vision behind the film and these questions about representing female bodies and how mm-hmm. important it was to me to have, you know, like, an authentic body in this film. And, you know, there are absolutely moments where it was uncomfortable for her, but she was so understanding of the vision behind that and the importance of it. And also, so, you know, understanding of, like, sometimes she was like, oh, I have cellulite and that makes me really uncomfortable, but I'm going to do it. Like, I'm going to
yeah.
let that happen, because that's what my body actually looks like. And I thought that was incredibly brave of her.
That's also, I'm sure, probably a little bit freeing. You're like, no, you know what? I do. I've got cellulite. It's totally fine. Whatever you want.
Exactly.
So, I mean, in keeping with that, I think that something that I found in my research that was actually pretty fascinating was that Megan Fox had a clause where she was not going to bare her breasts. And in this movie or in any photograph or anything, she's, you know, perfectly fine with being sexy and she'll like show her ass or something like that. She had stated from the get-go that she did not want to show her breasts because she said something about how the world, that industry is so, you know, like the machinations of it will eat you up and it will own you. And she said, the one thing I don't want people to own is my body. I want that for me. And so, mm-hmm. you know, that's for myself and for, you know, the people that I choose to show it to. But that's something that I don't want, you know, my soul to be out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that, you know, like, she knew her boundaries pretty early on. She was quite young when she made this movie.
Yeah.
And there was a point, though, when they were filming where a paparazzi took a long lens photo of her nude, topless, and went and sold it. And that was also something that disappointed fans when they realized that she wasn't actually going to be nude in the film. But it makes me extremely angry to think that, you know, in all the interviews she was talking about, like, no, I, you know, I've made the decision. I don't want to be topless and I don't want that, like, a photograph of me out there. And then this guy just steals it.
Yeah.
And it makes me
that makes
incredibly
me so mad
angry.
Too. I'm like sitting here like seething. And I think it just comes down to this, like, honestly, male entitlement over the female body. Like, we commodify the female body and, you know, a lot of industries decide that they own that and they own the rights to that. And I respect Megan Fox so much for setting those boundaries for herself. And, you know, I experienced something similar, you know, working in the porn industry. I poured my heart and my soul into my content. I worked so hard for it. And I would have it pirated and screen captured and thrown up all over the internet without any attribution to me.
Mm-hmm.
It would just say, like, pale, frizzy-haired pale girl.
Oh, my
God. You know,
God.
Does whatever. And I would look at myself, like, masturbating, this, like, disembodied image of myself that was in no way linked to me anymore. And it felt so violating.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can't imagine, you know, how it felt to her to have someone just take that picture of her when she was so explicitly stating her boundaries.
Yeah. And it turned out, like, Diablo Cody and Karin Kusama knew who took the paparazzi photo. There's nothing that they could really do. It was already out there. And
right.
It was just like they had to be like, roll their eyes and move on, you know?
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break. And then when I come back, I want to get into kind of the nitty gritty about writing dialogue for a horror film. So one quick break and we'll be right back.
Hey, Kira. So Max FunCon tickets go on sale this Friday, November 23rd at 11 a.m. Pacific, and I'm trying to write a promo.
Okay, so what do they need to know to look forward to? Inspiring classes.
Live podcast tapings.
A stand-up showcase.
The s'mores party.
Making new friends.
Don't forget about the dance party!
Oh, and it all takes place on a beautiful mountaintop.
Okay, got it. Anything else?
Well, if we missed anything, they can find all the details at maxfuncon.com.
And we'll see you in June!
I think that went really well.
That was really good, too.
Yeah, that sounded good.
Great job!
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Issa Matze, and we are talking about Jennifer's Body. So, a lot of horror films aren't as driven by dialogue as this one is. Both Seyfried and Fox would get tongue-tied trying to deliver these precise and witty lines, with Fox getting the brunt with these longer, tough paragraphs with very interesting phrasing. But because Diablo Cody had won some awards for her script for Juno, there was the directive on set that none of the lines would be changed to make them easier to say. So the actress just had to work harder to say them and make them natural. And that is, I think, one of the strengths of this film. And the actors are so good that you're not even thinking about how difficult it might have been to deliver the lines. Seyfried said that the hardest part was not laughing at the laugh lines, obviously, because they're not supposed to be funny to the characters, only to the audience. The only person who was allowed to improv was Adam Brody, who was the lead guy in Low Shoulder.
He's so good.
And that's because his character was more shallowly drawn. And so Brody was able to fill him in with more satirical lines. Yeah. So from the sets that I've been on, there is a tension with the actors that if a line doesn't feel natural to them, that it always seems like the best thing to do is to change it to be flexible in the moment. And sometimes that works. But other times, you know, maybe the cast just needs to do the work to get to the place where it seems natural. And I always think that that's a big tension, you know, when you're trying to get this done and, you know, it's hard and everyone's just like, we just want you to finish the fucking line, you know, and like it's just not coming to them. But, you know, I do wonder how many brilliant lines might be lost because there just wasn't the time to make sure that the actor could get into it to make it feel natural.
Totally. I think that's always a question. And like, honestly, for us, we were pretty flexible on set with, you know, actors changing their lines. But a lot of that came from like actors having experience that, you know, I don't have, like Melora Walters, you know, who plays Alice's mom. She's a mom. She has a daughter, you know, so she would come on set and say, you know, if I found out my daughter was doing porn, this is what I would say. And I you know, I gave her full control to change those lines because I was like, you know, I'm writing it from the daughter perspective. I don't really know how a mother would feel. And so, you know, we collaborated a lot on those lines. But, you know, there were other lines that came down to like the politics behind the film of how we were representing a sex worker.
Yeah.
Where it did feel a lot more important to make sure the lines were as written, or at least we had, you know, the huge dialogue around them before they were changed. And, you know, maybe they didn't feel quite so natural, but it was important to us that they be stated correctly.
I mean, can you imagine getting to that point where you're Diablo Cody and people are like, never change her lines?
But I mean, she has so many good ones. Like, I love when they're like, you're Jell-O, lime green Jell-O. And Megan Fox delivers that line just so deadpan. Like, it's not... it's so good.
And it's so weird.
It's so weird. It's such a weird thing to say. And then someone earlier in the film called them like lesbi gays.
Yeah.
And I love that too. She has so many like little quips that are so bizarre, but so wonderful.
Yeah. I think, the bizarre, like kind of absurd idea. But it is, you know, like kind of high school lingo where you almost make up your own language as you go.
Totally. Totally. You're just throwing slang out there like... make it happen.
I mean, I think obviously the dialogue is wonderful, but I do, you know, I wonder what it was like for, I wish I would have known this and I would have asked Karin Kusama what it was like being like, okay, take 30.
Yeah.
We're like, going to get this dialogue.
Stay
done.
On this exact wording.
I would like to talk about how physically demanding movies like this can be, you know, for these actors. Because this turned out to be a very physically demanding role for both Megan and Amanda. As Fox said, they had a body cast of her torso so that when she was levitating and getting stabbed and all that in the end, you know, because that end scene is like it's a vicious, brutal fight, right? So she had that body cast on, and she was either wearing this cast or she was hooked up to this harness, and they were doing 12-hour days over the course of 3 days. So there was a lot of wrestling, and Fox came away with bruises on her neck from being strangled, while Siegfried's hips were black and blue from straddling Fox for hours. So for days, they ended up being literally strapped to one another in the most uncomfortable positions, you know, with Siegfried. Like, she's straddling her, and they're like, their faces are so close for 3 days straight, 12-hour days, where they just started getting loopy and, you know, just staring at each other, trying to crack each other up while all the shots are getting set up. And I don't think that we even talk enough about how physically demanding filmmaking can be.
Oh, my God. Yes. I think especially for the actors, it's exhausting.
Yeah.
It's exhausting.
I mean, you sign on for something like a horror film, and... you know, for an actor, it's something different because you may be screaming, which is also demanding. You know, you need to put your body through so much fear to try to get into that moment and be like, I'm scared now. So you're scared for days on end screaming. And that's it's exhausting.
Yeah, you know? Not to mention like all the blood pills you have to put in your mouth and all the, you know, latex gore applications that you have to sit for hours for, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, I know Madeline in our film, we had, you know, there's a scene where she slits her throat and we had to do all the prosthetics for that and get all the fake blood. And then there's blood pouring out of her mouth. And it's like, you know, it's a process. It's a lot of work. And then you have to clean her up and then you have to do it all over again and again and again and again.
I mean, that's an investment if you're doing a horror movie.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
That, I'm curious also, like, the writing the sex machine thing seems like it would have taken, like, a lot of physical prowess.
Yeah, I think absolutely, because she's kind of, like, perched on this thing.
Yeah, and describe then, that. Can you describe that? She's perched on, like,
She's perched on, like, a vibrating, like, saddle, basically. We call it a vibratron. And then, you know, there's another girl that's kind of controlling if it's going faster or slower or faster. And you know, there's all these lights on her. There's all these people staring at her. We tried to keep the room as empty as possible since it's kind of a sensitive scene. But I was in the room, you know, telling them faster, slower. And we have the camera just kind of circling them. And it was a very intense moment. And I think that also helped the performance because for the character, it's a really intense moment, too.
Yeah. How many takes did you do of that?
Not a lot, actually. We originally tried to do it as a single take. I think we ended up cutting it, but we didn't. You know, everything on this film was so tight. We didn't have a lot of time to really spend much time in any one scene. So it was kind of like, okay, we've got to do it. All right, we're done. Moving on.
Yes. You know? Yes. I think that we should also talk about, like, the mental toll that it takes. Siegfried said that, quote, I haven't been sleeping well. I don't know if it's because of all this. I know it's fake, but it seeps into my subconscious, and it affects me to a point where I can't even watch this kind of stuff. I had to watch when Jennifer was being sacrificed, and it was really difficult. So she was just kind of watching, you know, offset, you know, that scene, which is very tense and very scary and serious. And she said it gave her nightmares.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised. And I'm sure that I know that Maddie encountered similar things on our film, too, because, you know, we had this scene where she's watching herself shoot herself in the face, essentially.
Yeah.
And she had filmed the other side of that. You know, she had filmed the Lola sides of that, but we had sent it out to VFX to get the effects put in, and we played it back for her live on set. Like, she's watching this happen to herself.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely horrifying. You know, and she got really mad at Danny, actually, at first for playing it back for her. But, you know, she forgives us now, but she's come around. But you know, I think sometimes it's easy to overlook the psychological effects on the actors, too, because they are putting themselves in these really intense situations emotionally and psychologically, and then they're enduring it over and over and over again to get the right take.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I can't imagine how exhausting that is.
I think what I would like to do is go into realism, which I think ties into, you know, if these actors are trying to put themselves into the space, you know, they're trying to build realism, even if it's a surreal fucking world. And one of the ways, obviously, that you can do that is to have great dialogue that feels authentic to a moment. There's one scene in particular that Diablo Cody constantly calls out, and it is the one where I think Needy and her boyfriend Chip are having sex, and Needy or someone says, "Put it in." And Diablo Cody said, "Somebody needs to say that in a sex scene. It doesn't just magically go in." And I was thinking about that, and I'm like, yeah, you know, like that is a, like a realistic thing, something that I wasn't even thinking about when I watched it. But there is an authenticity to that. And I'm curious if you could talk about, you know, building more authenticity into the dialogue of how to really portray that world.
Yeah, I mean, I think it helps having lived it, you know, obviously. And, you know, with Cam, it was all about, you know, using the jargon that cam girls actually use and then trying to make sure that the audience could still understand that.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, looking back on like the scene in Jennifer's Body, like we've all had that awkward sex where you're like, is it in? Put it in? Where are you putting it?
Oh, my God, the sex is so awkward in that scene. And I'm just like, oh, I really love this.
That's
how
sex is in high school. You know,
it's like, so bad.
You don't know what you're doing. And you've got to ask sometimes. I think she does a really good job about that. And I think, yeah, with Cam, it was the same thing where it was like, I want, you know, Alice to feel like a real person, like making real jokes. And, you know, she's camming for like 8 hours a night. Not everything is going to be formal and scripted and perfect. She's going to like make weird jokes and, you know, that don't land. And she's going to kind of have her own inside jokes with her viewers. And and it's got to feel casual because that's how we talk.
And so often when you see teenagers having sex in movies or when you see sex workers, everything feels extremely artificial. You know, like if I can think of like all the sex scenes that I've seen in horror movies between teenagers, like who are horny, it's just like, oh, yeah, we definitely know how to do sex. And I'm like,
I know, it's so scripted. And like, I've never had sex like that, honestly. Like, it's never like that. And I think it's the same with sex workers. It's like they're not always some like super confident, you know, scripted, perfect, saying exactly the right dirty things that you want to say. Like sometimes they get mascara in their eye and they're laughing about it and there's a tear running down their face and it's funny.
Yeah.
You know? And so, yeah, you know, part of the impetus behind the film was to humanize sex workers. And part of that is to make them human.
Well, I think that's a great place for us to end, and I absolutely appreciate you coming in and talking to me about Jennifer's Body and Cam today.
Thanks so much. It was really fun.
And we can see Cam on Netflix November 16th. November 16th, so check it out. And thank you all for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. Devlin Morrow from the UK says April is an excellent host. She manages to capture and discuss interesting insights about the film at hand while relating these expertly to the guest's life and oeuvre. She keeps the discussion lively without glossing too fast over the details and always has a great rapport with her guests, who also tend to be intelligent and considered. It also provides me with an ongoing must-watch film list. Great stuff. Thank you so much, Devlin. And we've also got Fat Mermaid 21, who says, as a woman who is attempting to go back to school right now to learn how to direct horror movies, this podcast is so incredibly inspiring and informative. Love it to death. Totally amazeballs. Well, we love you. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at Switchblade Pod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.